Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Our occasion this evening is in the order of a celebration. This is the first of a four-year series of annual Reformation lectures. The lecturer for next year, as your program shows you, will be Dr. Franklin Littell. For 1966, Dr. Yaroslav Pelikan. 1967, Dr. Gordon Rupp. It's a combined celebration, really, of two great occasions, the 450th anniversary of the Reformation and the 125th anniversary of this institution. It's altogether fitting that our first Reformation lecturer for 1964 should be Dr. Lewis Spitz. He really is, and I should say this and sit down, I suppose, he really is someone who needs no introduction. And I will leave the reading of the curriculum vitae, the very distinguished curriculum vitae, to you, which also you will find in your program. Should say, too, that this particular lectureship this year was made possible by gifts in memory of the Reverend Dr. O.A. Geiseman, whose curriculum vitae also appears in the program. Dr. Spitz is going to lecture on occasions for joy, and he's given us just a hint to what it is this is going to entail. Going to speak about Northern European humanism, and one look at him is enough to remind me of a story which doesn't at all apply. The old Reformation scholar Preserved Smith. Preserved Smith once said about Desiderius Erasmus, a famous humanist, he said that if you look at the pictures of Erasmus, they suggest that he was descended from a long line of old women. The Reformation scholar we have before us tonight is, by contrast, very youthful indeed. And I'm sure that I passed my dexterity test. Let him that stole steal no more. We were speaking of Dr. Spitz's usefulness, and I'm sure as I survey the faces in this audience, and I see there are some veteran faculty people here who have lived in this campus community for a good many years, I'm sure that you will remember him and will have difficulty forgetting tonight that he was once a faculty youngster, being the son of our own Dr. Lewis Spitz Sr. But as he is going to demonstrate in short order, I promise you, he's come a long way since those days, and he's a very mature Reformation scholar in his own right. And so, Dr. Spitz, can we get the celebration underway?
Well, thank you. It's always fine to have a friend introduce you, you know. So after that fine introduction, I'm just dying to find out what I'm going to have to say. I have to remind Professor Bertram, however, that there's many a man who doesn't need an introduction who could certainly stand a good conclusion. As a matter of fact, his reference to Preservet Smith and the Northern Humanists brought to mind a comment that Preservet Smith once said about how the subject for a lecture or the title of a book is decided on. He said sometimes it's decided on just like the choice of a wife, strictly by accident. Or that the Northern Humanists lacked courage. They had to join sodalities and hunt culture in packs. I feel particularly inhibited speaking before an assemblage of theologians and philosophers, as the philosopher Hegel once said of Leopold von Ranke, er ist nur ein gewöhnlicher Historiker. And literateurs, ever since the days of Aristotle, have been quick to agree with Aristotle that history is less philosophical than poetry. No, at least it was the poet Goethe who said history is a web of nonsense to the higher thinker. So if tonight's talk seems confusing to you, you understand. We like to be taken seriously, however, as the poet Paul Valéry put it, history is the most dangerous potion ever concocted in the laboratory of the human mind. Now that's the way we like to be taken. And so in considering today's topic, this evening's topic, it seemed to me that instead of unloading on you the result of specialized research, because it was Jakob Burckhardt who said that a timber of the quality that is able to do more than just prove its own blindness by devotion to specialized research is rare indeed. Now, rather than suffer the scorn of Burckhardtians, I thought this evening I would talk about a subject which is large enough to cover Renaissance, Reformation, and the 125th anniversary. And in trying to decide where to begin, I turned to Jakob Burckhardt, who said, "We will begin in the one place available to us, namely with the question, what is man?" Which had enough of a biblical ring to it that I thought even a theologian wouldn't mind introducing this particular subject. And it was Burckhardt who commented on the mysterious nature of history. This is a fashionable refrain down to Heidegger in his Holzwege, where he dwells, in fact, revels in the mysterious nature of history. In fact, Burckhardt says great events like the Reformation can never really be understood because they remain in their essence forever mysterious. Now, this Jakob Burckhardt, in discussing the question of Renaissance and Reformation, has sort of set the stage for the discussion of this problem and the place of man in cultural history ever since. It was a colleague of his, a gentleman named Nietzsche, who once paid him this tribute, having heard Burckhardt deliver his Zeitgeschichtliche Gedanken, his reflections on history. He said to him, "This, for the first time in my life, I have enjoyed a lecture." And it was this Nietzsche who gave us a picture of Renaissance man, which has become the common property of the Western world since in varying forms and various modalities. Konrad Burckhardt has summarized this Nietzschean view of Renaissance man in this way: Renaissance man as the free, genial personality, fresh and wanton in bold sinfulness, the type of an ascetic immoralist, the domineering, fame-seeking, power-hungry, insatiable voluptuary, the frivolous despiser of religion who nevertheless keeps peace with the church and its servants because he views it as an indispensable device for managing the masses by deception. This is a view of the Renaissance contrasted, of course, after all, his joie de vivre, with the Reformation, to which Nietzsche attributed great historical power, saying if the Reformation had not intervened, the papacy may have succeeded in secularizing Western culture without outside interference. Now, the problem to which I would like to address these comments this evening is the problem of the Renaissance conception of man and the Reformation conception of man, with a look back and a look forward, the forward being to the here and now, that specious 3.5 seconds which Whitehead describes as the present, which as long as any human being is able to concentrate on a given subject before his thoughts belong to the past. When one views the Renaissance closely, one discovers that far from being an age of overweening courage, this is an age in which the miseria of man is emphasized quite as much and in certain phases much more than the famous refrain, De Dignitate Hominis, as Pico's oration puts it, as a classic Renaissance document as it is often described. And this theme of misery and dignity of man is one which has, as you know, both classical and Christian, particularly patristic, roots. And before that, biblical. In the Renaissance, it was particularly Ovid and Cicero. These two who became the prime sources for this optimistic view of man. And I need only remind you of Ovid's Metamorphosis and the story of Prometheus shaping man from the dust and the waters and so forth, and giving him a face which can look upward toward heaven and hands which can rise toward the stars and so forth. And you will recognize this Ovidian refrain, men are little gods. The second major source is Cicero's, in his De Natura Deorum, for example, for men are from the earth, not as inhabitants or dwellers, but as spectators of the higher and heavenly things, he writes, a view of which things belongs to no other kind of living beings. A quotation which one can find used also in Luther, among others. Now, this view of man as a great creation, as the supreme being on earth, is a view which was expressed very often and consistently and persistently in the patristic literature. Even St. Augustine, who in these last days of the empire was long on the misery of mankind, could speak of man as opus eius tam magnet admirabile. This view that one sees reflected, for example, in Lactantius's De Apothecia Dei on man as the special creation of God. Listen to this. For that creator of ours and Father God has given to man sense and reason, so that it might be apparent from this that we have been created by him, since he is himself intelligence, sense, and reason. This kind of statement found very eloquently expressed in the Mesias of Emesa, who in the Renaissance period was frequently confused with Gregory of Nyssa from glory to glory, and not accidentally, because they both had this high and almost exaggerated view of man's importance. Could write sentences, and I think if I were to read Pico's oration to you together with Nemesius' oration, you could not distinguish the one from the other. Listen to these lines. Who can fittingly admire the dignity of man, who joins in himself the mortal and immortal, the rational and irrational, who bears in his own nature the image of the whole creation, and for this reason is called a microcosm or little world, who is God's special care, and for whose sake God made all things and himself became man? Who can enumerate the excellence and ornaments of the nature of man? He crosses the seas, he penetrates the heavens, with the eye of the mind, he understands the course of the stars and their intervals and sizes. No science, order, doctrine escapes his penetration. He foresees the future. He rules over all, he dominates all, enjoys all, speaks with the angels and with God, commands at his pleasure all other creatures, subjugates the demons, learnedly investigates the natural world and the essence of God, becomes a house and a temple of God, and achieves all this by piety and virtue. Now, if you can distinguish this from Pico's De Dignitate Hominis, I would be exceedingly surprised. This view of the dignity of man is one that was represented not merely in the Greek fathers, but one which is stressed also in the liturgy. If you think of those words that are spoken at the time of the preparation of the cup for Mass, have you ever reflected on the anthropological significance of those words, Deus qui humani substantiae dignitate mirabiliter condidisti et mirabilius reformasti? If you think of that in all the churches throughout the medieval period, this emphasis on the dignity of man, distribute to man as God's creature and as that being whom God did not hesitate to join in the incarnation. One can see that these ideas trickled down and were spread out throughout the Corpus Christianum through this agency. Or to select a high medieval figure, William of St. Thierry, who says, O imago Dei, O image of God, recognosce dignitatem tuam. Recognize your dignity, refulgiat in te authoris effigies. O image of God, recall your dignity, let the image of the author shine brightly in you, and so forth. Or to pick a fine, high example of the monastic expression, Bernard of Clairvaux in his treatise on Humana Conditio, in which he has a chapter entitled De Dignitate Hominis, in which he speaks of man as Celsa Creatura in Capacitate Majestatis, the creature who is the greatest in his capacity for majesty. This is this leading spokesman of a medieval point of view. So that the discovery of the dignity of man is not a Renaissance discovery. As those of you who are close students of the writings of Pope Innocent III know very well, his treatise, De Contemptu Mundi, was intended to be only half of a statement, of which the second part was to be De Dignitate Hominis. And then he got involved in administration, and that's the last writing he did. But there is a new element added in the Renaissance. You notice in the classic writing and in the patristic writing, and in the medieval just quoted, there are two grounds for the dignity of man. In the first place, his natural condition as a creation, and in the case of the Christian tradition, because of the Deus Incarnatus, hence Homo Divinatus. However, in the Renaissance, in Boccaccio, in the Genealogia de Roma, concerning the genealogy of the gods, the time mythological description of the classical pantheon. The Boccaccio gives a classical expression to the idea of the second, Prometheus. That is, that it is not the man in his natural estate who has dignity, but that it is man in a newly made state. And he says this second Prometheus is Eled Justus, that learned man, who because of his acquired dignity, which rests upon his intellectual achievements and his cultural stature, that makes him a man of real dignity. This idea is expressed this way in a rather true translation. He makes out of natural man civil man, the second Prometheus, remarkable for morals, knowledge, and virtue, with the cruder popular alias to this system of foreign and so forth. So that he clearly reveals that nature has produced them, but learning has reformed them. Now, this idea of the factor becomes the standard Renaissance preserve. Like Fred Allen says, you know, hush little bright line, don't cry, you'll be a cliche by and by. And you find this idea reflected all the way down to the Prince of the Northern Humanist, to get down to Mr. Burton's announcing Erasmus, who writes three, or perhaps find it. It may be sterile or heavy with fruit. Horses are born, it may be useless, but believe me, men are not born, they are molded. After that, it is the culturally creative nature which rises to real humanity and achieves real dignity. And the great Platonic philosopher Socino, the founder of the
I like to think of them as the Academy players, who said the human arts bring forth of their own powers that which nature itself produces, as though they were not servants, but rivals of nature. So that man certainly no longer depends on his natural condition, but on what he achieves almost in spite of nature. Now, on this question of the dignity of man, I suppose the apotheosis of, in terms of its old tradition, is not really Tito's De Dignitate Hominis, but it is really Manetti, this man who was called soberly before the King of Naples, who posed the great question of the 15th century, what is the whole duty of man? Whereupon he snapped at them to intellegere et agere, to understand and to act. Now, this Manetti did a treatise, De Dignitate et Celestia Hominis, which reflects line by line the point of view of our Manetti. The genius of man is such that all these things, after that first new and rude creation of the world, seem to have been discovered and completed and perfected by us with a certain unique and extraordinary acumen of mind. For things which are perceived or ours, that is, are human things, since they have been made by men, all houses, all towns, all cities, those phrases incidentally are taken from Cicero. In short, all edifices on earth, which certainly are so great and such that they ought rightly to be considered the works of angels rather than of men, on account of this great excellence of theirs, ours are the pictures, ours the sculptures, ours are the arts, ours the sciences. Manetti didn't know, but he was very shortly to be exiled and then he was saved in poverty in the northern part of Europe. It is our people who calls man the couple of Mundi, the midstream in the whole great chain of being. Or the great Alberti, the great Austerlitz, who says that fortune places under bondage only those who are willing to submit to her. This is the bravado side of the Renaissance, the dignity and the bravery of man in the face of fortune. It's a point of view that you find in Vivos' De Fabula Hominis, for example, or in Vivos' Liber Sapiens and so forth. Now, this is the well-known side of the Renaissance. Or the other side of the Renaissance view of man, and if you have only this side, the contrast with the Reformation is quite easy to see, as Hegel once put it, the superficial mind. However, the other side requires more documentation and, I suppose, more publicity. It was our friend Jakob Burckhardt again who did this treatise on Brutus's pessimism, in which he quoted Aristotle in his answer to the question, what is man? A true mark of weakness, he says, the toy of the moment, a toy of fortune, a picture of sudden change. Now subject more to envy, now more to misfortune, the rest is all flying gold. The picture that one has of the medieval view is one that is quite easy to find in that most read of the philosophical authors, that late classic so-called Christian Stoic Boethius. Remember Boethius' lines in the Pendulationa, for to be our hapless state of human race, how quick do all their pleasures pass, and too weak their minds to bear life's vague, a scene of ill
hither soon gives way, doth melancholy cloud here goes. The helm no longer reason steers, but lawless passion domineers. I think the theme about riding is that very few people die laughing. What is not so well known, however, is that Boethius was also a favorite author throughout the Renaissance period, among particularly the northern humanists, and was not limited in popularity to across Middle Ages. Now, what is very striking if one gets a really close look at the Renaissance humanists, is the deep current of uncertainty and pessimism that runs throughout their writings. And I say throughout deliberately because it is not, as Hans Sloane put it in his article on Franciscan poverty and Italian humanism, not a phenomenon of the Seicento, but it is one that can be traced in a broad path through the 16th century. And this, it seems to me, is culturally very significant. It is Plutarch, who is the man who is sunk down in melancholy and misery to the torn soul, who writes to Plutarch, let me vary how many. It is the first modern man who converses with St. Augustine about the question, why am I so sad? Just some peculiar answers. One very un-Augustinian answer being because you have too low an opinion of yourself. But if one sees the side of Plutarch that emerges in the state person, the ascetic withdrawal side in the Vita Solitaria, one sees that Plutarch passed from being an ebullient, self-confident, postmodern man, but is one who is torn, plagued by this question of the melancholy in his soul. He then is a kind of symbol for the four types of melancholy that appears here and there in strength throughout this period. The one you might describe sort of in clinical terms, a synonym being mania, a sickness, a psychological aberration, this can appear in any period. The second is a kind of medieval carryover of the old apidia, or apidia, which the German scholars like to call Klosterkrankheit. It is a form represented largely by sloth, an inability to do anything, to be active, to be involved. Dante describes it somewhat where he describes the plague of the insect. You stimulate this man to some kind of action. Or the famous image of the hot rods applied to this lawful person, and the Renaissance painter Fra Angelico has described this in a beautiful painting which is hanging in the Berlin Dahlem Museum as the significance of acidia, melancholy as this loss, this inability to action. A third time might be associated with the idea of endymion. It is the restless heart, that old call of the creative. It is a feeling of dissatisfaction, of sort of faustian seeking. It is what the Germans call genie, they did. It is the problem of the endymion, of the genius. It's what André Gide described in his famous lines about when one has talent, one does what one wishes. When one has genius, one does what one can. And this is a
a form that appears also in Petrarch, his inability to get things done at Semiramis from Leonardo and so forth. There's a fourth form which melancholy takes in the Renaissance, which is associated with the idea of fortuna. Instead of taking up arms to fight this outrageous fortune, this submitting to her against Alberti's best counsel. The third category is strong in the High Renaissance, and the fourth category is evident everywhere at the end of the 15th century following the invasion. But all four are found in strength throughout the Renaissance period. It is Ficino, for example, who writes the De Vita Triplici, which Christeller has called that dietetic of the Saturnine man. He suffered a period of melancholy lasting over 3 years, as he describes it, with tremendous torment, the founder of the Platonic school. But among Hans Baron's civic humanists, when he's only to look at Salutatis de Seculo et Religione, where he advises that one should flee from the abyss, or Leonardo Bruni, that great defender of republicanism against the Milanese tyranny in his Ice Agogan Moralia Disciplina, or Poggio, the well-known literary humanist, who is often, for example, in Crane Brinton's History of Western Morals, described as one of these effervescent Renaissance types. Rita's De Miseria Humanae Conditionis, a more sorrowful, melancholy description of the human condition, I think you could not match in all of medieval literature. One need not then go down to the dregs of the Renaissance, to Guicciardini, who wrote, of course, after the invasions, when I consider how many accidents and perils of infirmity are chance, of violence, and in infinite ways the life of man is subjected to, I marvel all the more to see an old man or a fruitful year. But this is a standard thing in the Renaissance and raises the question of why. Why should there be this flu of melancholy? What should be the dawn? The golden age of modern time. Various suggestions have been made. One, that this is the price that's paid for broader horizons. That these people were unable to integrate all this new classical learning with their closed universe received from the medieval period, from the Dante kind of world. A second is that the melancholy streak in classical literature began to make itself felt, and one recent cultural historian has stressed that the Renaissance was, to a very large extent, a recovery of late classical antiquity. But it seems to me that even the authors of the Golden Age and of the Silver Age in classical writings represented enough of this side of the human condition that these ecstatic Renaissance humanists could absorb it directly. Think, for example, of Pliny's description in the 7th book of the Historia Naturalis, where he talks about the weakness of man. Man is the only creature who cries and who begins crying at first. Or think of Plutarch's Grilus, where he says animals may have some virtue and reason, but do not have those drives which send a man to war to kill his brother and make him hunt him out across the whole world in order to destroy him. Arwen thinks of Matthew Arnold's lines on that hard Roman world. Disgust and secret loathing fell, and bitterness and hated lust made human life a hell. There was this side also to the revival of classical antiquity our 19th century haters of the 19th century and lovers of the Renaissance were apt to overlook. Let me read to you some lines from the Theological Monthly,
Mr. Mayor's honor.
It was an article done by Professor Montgomery on Pico della Mirandola, in which the great Pico of the Dignitate Hominis fame is commenting on some scriptural passages. Now, if Pico is indeed, as he has been acclaimed to be, the great symbol of the Renaissance view of man, then these lines come with particular force. He's commenting here on the commentary on Psalm 16. Conserva me, Domine. That is to say, keep me, good Lord. Which word keep me, if it be well considered, taketh away all occasion of pride. For he that is able of himself anything to get is able of himself that same thing to keep. He that asketh then of God to be kept in the state of virtue signifies in that asking that from the beginning he got not that virtue by himself. He that which remembereth that he attained his virtue not by his own power but by the power of God may not be proud thereof, but rather humbled before God, after those words of the apostle, quid habes quod non accipisti, what hast thou that thou hast not received? And if thou hast received it, why art thou proud thereof as though thou hast not received it? Two words then there be which we should ever have in our mouth. The one, miserere mei Deus, have mercy on me, Lord, when we remember our vice. That other, conserva me Deus, keep me, good Lord, when we remember our virtue. Or that powerful exposition of the Lord's Prayer by Pico, in which, in summary, he writes, all consideration of this prayer is reduced to a consideration of Christ's cross and our own death. Our own death shows us truly that we are pilgrims on earth, and the death of Christ has made us sons of God. So that thinking neither of an earthly father nor of an earthly fatherland, we may rightly say, Our Father who art in heaven. Our death keeps us from seeking our own glory, for we shall soon be dust and ashes. And Christ's death makes us desire God's glory, for on our behalf he did not shrink from the disgrace of the cross. Therefore we shall say, Hallowed be thy name, as if we were saying, Not to us, Lord, not to us, but to thy name give glory. Moreover, if we remember that all men swiftly perish through death, we shall want Christ to rule among them. Pico died in the year of the Great Invasion. This is not an expression of the breakup of Italian Renaissance culture and so forth, but comes at what should properly have been the culmination of resounding confidence and dignity in the dignity of man. This theme plays on into the 16th century and is reflected in, well, it's reflected early already in the writings of Pomponazzi, where he says one should be submissive to natural laws because there is no point in opposing. Incidentally, recently I learned that our famous Cajetan of Reformation history was a good friend of Pomponazzi and adopted his views on the body-soul dichotomy and so forth. Or in Montaigne's famous lines, when I play with my cat to kill time, who knows but what the cat is playing with me? Now, insofar as there are many distinguished Luther scholars before and behind me, I shall make merely a few suggestive reminders of Luther's response to this question of melancholy, this question of sadness of the soul. He has a very brusque answer. The Christian need not be melancholy. As a matter of fact, the entire thrust of his sales order activity, if you have browsed through Tappert's really charming volume of Letters of Spiritual Counsel,
Luther's whole effort here is to help people transcend their melancholy with all sorts of advice about seeking out the company of one's fellows and don't sit alone and brood. Had to think of Petrarch's De Vita Solitaria in that connection. It's true. Luther says, I give this advice, although I do not take it myself. Nevertheless, with respect to these people who are ready to write off a total culture as being lost in unbelief and so forth, in the year 1522, which was not a smashing year of triumph for Luther, as you recall, he writes to Elector Frederick of Saxony, have a little confidence. Fool though I am, for I know these and other like tricks of Satan, I do not fear him because I know this hurts him. Yet all of this is only a beginning. Let the world cry out and pass its judgment. Let those fall away who will. Even a St. Peter or persons like the apostles, they will come back on the third day when Christ rises from the dead. Cum plantata est fides hoc agendum est ut Christianis in negotiosissimi erga proximum et prorsus nullum hic agunt sabbatum sed zelotae bonorum operum. This is Luther's most powerful word against melancholy. He says, first, make the venture of faith and then get busy like zealots doing good works to your fellow man. It is an appeal in his rediscovery of this historical core of Christianity, an appeal to move on from primary faith to action. There's no doubt that on this whole Renaissance Reformation discussion of the vita activa and contemplativa and studiosa, that Luther is on the studiosa activa side after the initial step. He knows what is needed is this cor peccatum, as he puts it. And one of his most interesting commentaries is one that has been the least noticed. It's his commentary on Ecclesiastes, where he discusses these questions of skepticism and difficulties. Now, the Renaissance the Renaissance melancholy had moved over the Alps with humanism. The Ficino's De Vita Triplici had been republished in Strasbourg already before the turn of the century. And Petrarch's De Remediis Utriusque Fortuna had been republished in as late as 1507. And the humanistically inclined artist, preeminently Albrecht Dürer, had already absorbed this kind of Renaissance pessimism. It was Albrecht Dürer who in 1514 carved that great artistic masterpiece, the Melancholia One, which is the grandest portrayal of this melancholy mood. And what is less well known is that 2 years later in 1516, he did a print, which he called Der Verzweifelnde Mensch, Doubting Man. And it was Rudolf Stadelmann who did this description of Germany in Ausgang des Mittelalters, in which he said it is skepticism, pessimism, resignation, together with some rebirth of activity, which was characteristic of German culture at the end of the Middle Ages. And it is in this cultural milieu of the intellectuals. And Carl von Gielow, the great cultural historian, has described the way in which this Renaissance melancholy had infiltrated into the circle of humanists around Maximilian at the Habsburg court. This is the direction in which the culture of Northern Europe was moving. When Luther appears on the scene with his energetic and dramatic reassertion of faith and trust in God as the answer to man's melancholy skepticism and resignation.
Since Luther's day, Western man has suffered a number of affronts to his dignity. One of the first of these, of course, was in Luther's own day, the De Revolutionibus. And it's interesting to read in Sigmund Freud that he says Copernicus's work on the revolution of the heavenly bodies had the same effect on Western man's view of himself as my discovery of the subconscious had. It did. Read John Donne. This is 1611. This is not very late, actually. The new philosophy calls all in doubt. The element of fire is quite put out. The sun is lost, and the earth, and no man's wit can well direct him where to look for it. And freely men confess that this world's spent, when in the planets and the firmament they seek so many new, then see this and that is crumbling out again to his antinomies. More dramatically still, just by way of a reminder, Pascal's famous lines, when I consider the short duration of my life, swallowed up in the eternity before and after the little space which I fill, and even can see engulfed in the infinite immensity of spaces of which I am ignorant and which know me not, I am frightened. And am astonished at being here rather than there. Why now rather than then? So this is one dimension. And perhaps with the breakup of the Newtonian worldview, man has even less certainty derived from the knowledge of nature. A contemporary poet has caught the problem here very nicely. Barbara Bayer Solomon. She writes, Newton's world no longer exists, and quantum chance, paths chance persist, subtle device and extension of random chance to man's intention. We've gone a long way since Pope could say nature and nature's world was bathed in light. God said, let Newton be in there with light. Yeah. In fact, André Malraux, who appears in Time magazine every other week, writes Western civilization has begun to doubt its own credentials. We seem, as a matter of fact, to be in such a period of transition, history is always, of accelerated transition, such as Western culture has seen twice before. And it's interesting that our friend Jakob Burckhardt perceived this change. In the Renaissance period, it was that perceptive Erasmus who said, Videmus fatalem quondam rerum humanorum mutationem. I see a strange, fatal transmutation taking place in human affairs. It was this cultural analyst, Jakob Burckhardt, who in the 19th century says, we have optimism. How long will it last? We are living in centuries such as the second and third centuries of our era. His contemporary was Kierkegaard, you know, who in 1843 wrote, our age reminds one vividly of the dissolution of the Greek city-state. Everything goes on as usual, unless there is no longer anyone who believes in it. The invisible spiritual bond which gives its validity no longer exists. And so the whole age is at once comic and tragic. Tragic because it is perishing, comic because it goes on. For it is always the imperishable which sustains the perishable, the spiritual, the corporal. Now, it is true that intellectuals are not always right in their assessment of a given civilization and the direction in which it is moving. However, it is also true that what intellectuals believe has a way of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it seems to me that if one surveys the predominant tendency
not just of the older school, but, and what is more alarming, of the younger intellectuals who are attracting attention because they seem to be speaking to the beliefs of the younger people, that a similar pattern is emerging in the United States, as has long become evident on the European scene. On the European scene, it was this journalist, Gerhard Zesny, who attracted bigger crowds than Heidegger in lecturing at the universities, where he called on the Christian Democratic Party to be honest. Today, the real Christian creed viewed in the broad scarcely survives as a vitally creative force. The peoples of the West live out their lives, and this takes into account the majority of those who call themselves Christians, in their thinking and behavior, have ceased to pay the least attention to Christianity's idea of God, the hereafter, or the Christian notion of sin and grace, and so forth. On the American scene, one of the brightest persons of whom I know is this Harvard-trained psychology professor at Yale, Kenneth Kenniston, who wrote in the American Scholar an article which I commend to you for some real analytical reading, called Alienation and the Decline of Utopia. This is an age that inspires little enthusiasm in the industrial West, and increasingly now in the uncommitted nations of the East. Ardor is lacking. Instead, men talk of their growing distance from one another, from their social order, from their work and play, and even from the values that in a perhaps romanticized past seem to have given their lives cohesiveness and direction, and so forth. Crane Brinton, his book for 1960 was entitled The Fate of Man. He's known to the undergrads as Brain Clinton. This huge volume has a great collection of essays of the analysis of the human situation by articulate contemporary intellectuals, including people like the omnipresent Joseph Wood Crouch, his books on human nature, human condition, even some references to Dirk Jellema of Case Institute, what is this postmodern mind, and so forth. So what I'm suggesting is that perhaps this rather dour picture presented by our contemporary rhino birds. These are the intellectuals who perch on the shoulders of our muscular society and rise up, warning of danger, and so forth. That perhaps the shadowy picture presented by these people is less frightening if one remembers that our culture has gone through periods like this before. The late classic period, the late medieval and Renaissance period, and now the late modern world. Like the second and third century, said Burckhardt. What was the response of a, I believe, typical intellectual Christian in this period? Let me read to you a few lines from Clement of Alexandria, who transposes Platonic intellectualism into, if I may pull out the existential plug, existentialist context. He uses one of Plato's dialogues. You know, Plato in his Phaedrus, for example, is great on the melancholy of the young genius and so forth, of the restless heart. Clement knows Plato well, and he uses one of his dialogues. He says, Alcibiades, do you not think that I shall know about what is right otherwise? Socrates, yes. If you have found out, Alcibiades, but you don't think I have found out. Socrates, certainly, if you have thought. Alcibiades, then you don't think I have thought. Socrates yet?
If you think you don't know. And then
Clement of Alexandria goes on by saying, and so with the lamps of the wise virgins lighted at night in the great darkness of ignorance, with the scriptures which the scripture signifies by night, wise souls pure as virgins, understanding themselves to be situated amidst the ignorance of the world, kindle the light, rouse the mind, illumine the darkness, dispel ignorance, seek truth, and wait for the appearance of our teacher. If Luther encountered melancholy in terms of a personal anfechtung, as well as in the general mood of his age, his response was this: we have more occasions for joy than for sadness. We believe in the living God, and Christ lives, and we too shall live. Sadness is born in us, but God is the spirit of gladness. He saves us. We must hold on to the fact that God does not desert his own. God did not create us with heads that hang down like the beast, but with faces, quoting Cicero, that look up toward the heavens. And so it seems to me that viewed within this broad pattern of cultural history, and against the framework of contemporary society and cultural trends, that perhaps the 125th anniversary of an institution that stands within this Christian tradition becomes particularly significant. The same Nietzsche with whom we began our discussion said something very wise: before man den Menschen sucht, muss man die Laterne gefunden haben. It seems to me that that this anothentophos, this from above the light, that the seminary motto has to do with, is relevant as a laterna in seeking man. I can think of no lines more forcefully to this point than in W.H. Auden's lines that seem to catch the whole problem and the only possible answer. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet, dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just, I suppose we'd say the justified, exchange their messages. May we, composed by them, of era and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
You have just said what I was going to say. When I promised you before that this very youthful-looking scholar was really quite mature, I had no idea that he was as mature as he turned out to be. I suspect that he's even advanced to his anecdotage. He's not only a very youthful man, I was impressed with the fact of what a joyful man he is. I think I caught this perhaps even more intimately than you folks did. Did you notice how he could read these grim, morose quotations about man's melancholy and his miseria, and all of them with this devilish little cackle? And I can vouch, too, that part of his thesis, which he paraphrased with saying that one of the humanist motifs was that few people die laughing, can be supported by even further evidence. I'm reminded of one anecdote from the Times, so I must warn you, I can't produce the documentation for this, at least not in Latin. I think the story went something like this. There was this German Junker who was going with some of his troops down a road through his territory, and he was ambushed. And when the rescue party finally caught up with those who had been ambushed, they moved around from corpse to corpse and found that there was finally only the Junker himself who lay there barely breathing, with a long bow shaft stuck into his chest, and he was obviously drawing his last breath. And one of his considerate men stooped over him and said to his lord, he said, "Does it hurt?" Whereupon the Junker said, "Only when I laugh." That is really what I meant by anecdotage. Mr. Spitz has agreed beforehand that he's willing to field questions from the group, if there are any, and wouldn't be at all surprised that there are all sorts of questions. Struck me, for example, I don't want to put ideas into your own minds, but on a campus community like this, you may say, well, we're familiar with the symptom of the restless heart that he spoke of. We're familiar with the symptom of Fortuna. You may want to ask him about this sloth syndrome. Particularly unfamiliar to us. Or I thought of another question that you might like to ask him. You noticed how frequently he began his translations of these long Latin passages only to stop in the middle and say, "and so on." And the thought crossed my mind, I wonder how well you would get along in an exegesis course if being asked to translate a passage in Hebrew or Greek. You took the first three verses of the 10, and when you got to the third one, you would simply say, "and so forth." you might want to press him to finish those translations for you. Or perhaps you have still other questions. Well away.
That reference to the Latin quotation, I was telling some of the students this afternoon that I decided once last semester that the way to upgrade the students' appreciation of the teaching profession would be to, you know, insert a little Latin Greek. Tuesday one said, what Latin teaching Greek is clear, the less that chapter when it's pressed in the message. I got up to the lectern one day, and here was this, like the French king, the bear of the placard, this poster attached to the lectern. And it said, does our professor know his Latin? Yes, oh yes. He is quite a linguist, we confess. He makes Christian orations with Latin quotations, and what it all means, let's just guess.